Hey, you're going to love this interview with Chris Powers. He has more than $1 billion worth of real estate under management at his private equity firm, Fort Capital. We talk about how he's built that business, how he balances the identity of investor and entrepreneur, and how focusing on a very specific niche of real estate has led to stratospheric growth. I learned a ton from this. I know you will as well. Here is Chris Powers. We've talked with folks in the past, like Ben Hunt from Epsilon Theory, and in the world, I mean, every industry has their jargon and their terminology, but particularly investing, finance, there's these terms that, you know, make perfect sense to the insider and can feel foreign and daunting to the outsider. So when I say, you know, Chris, your business, Fort Capital, manages over $1 billion, you invest in Class B industrial real estate, primarily in a couple states, Texas, Florida, Tennessee, the Carolinas. What does that actually mean? Like, help me paint a more vivid picture of what your business is doing on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah, so probably the best way to start would just be what Class B Industrial is. And so Class B Industrial to us, and we buy kind of inside the loop, and I can talk about our markets. But a lot of folks, when they think about the industrial that's being built today, it's these really large mega warehouses that you see companies like Amazon in and Target, and just name some of the biggest companies. We don't buy those. We buy buildings that were built. Class B, by definition, is kind of the vintage in which it was built. So think of buildings from the 70s to the 90s. These are smaller. It's called shallow bay, but it's smaller properties that are older. We buy multi-tenant, so lots of tenants in one building rather than one tenant. Because of when they were built, we call it inside the loop. In these major cities that we acquire in, they're inside, the major infrastructure. When they were built, it might have been the outskirts of town, but by this day and age, it's now what we consider in mature areas. So there's mature infrastructure around. There's rooftops. There's commercial enterprise. There could be universities, hospital systems. So these are the buildings that are in the loop. They are built from the 70s to the 90s, and the tenants that are in them are a lot of times the tenants that kind of maintain the built world, especially in growing areas. So think contractors, think service providers, think, you know, smaller businesses that provide material to the area. And so we might have a 200,000 foot building, and we might have, you know, 30 or 40 tenants in it that have a small office and maybe a warehouse in the back. And these buildings are, I joke, they're probably the ugliest buildings in town. You would never drive by one of these and remember, you know, thank you, man, that was such a great looking building. But they serve a huge need in society. A lot of the businesses that run our world, a lot of the businesses around the world are in these buildings. And you can't replicate these buildings in the major cities because they require a lot of land. They're not cheap to build anymore. And so you have this really steady supply of demand and tenant base, but you don't have any new supply coming on board. And so it sets up for a nice investment thesis, which is over the long term, if you believe that tenant demand will continue to be there, but supply is not going to keep up, that usually, you know, pushes rent prices up, which is good if you're an owner of a building. And that's where we decided to focus. I mentioned inside the loop, and I mentioned primary markets. So we are interested in buying in mature areas, which I call inside the loop, in growing cities. So in Texas, we're in San Antonio, Houston, DFW, El Paso. We'd like to get into Austin. So we're not buying in kind of tertiary markets. In Florida, we're looking in Orlando, Miami, Tampa. In Georgia, we're looking at Atlanta. In the Carolinas, we're looking at Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte. So we want to be buying in cities that are growing. We believe will continue to grow. And those tend to be throughout the Sun Belt where we're focusing, which is, you know, a very pro-business and light government area. And so you're seeing a lot of businesses and people move here. It's a little more affordable to live. And so that's kind of the high level thesis. I can get really into the weeds and we can see where we go, but that is basically what we're investing in.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's always frankly puzzled me about real estate is it seems almost infinitely divisible in the way that you could either niche or focus a strategy, right? It's such a freaking enormous industry in total. There's commercial, there's residential, there's, you know, as you said, major markets, micro markets. We could cut it so many different ways. Can you just tell us more about not specifically the decision of why this focus, but the choice at almost like a personal level to basically filter and pair what maybe you were pursuing in the past to hone in on a single area? Because, you know, with my business, it's similar. We do video, right? You could apply a video to a lot of different applications. But what we've found as we've honed in on a couple few specific B2B service providing businesses, we can not only do better work for them, but we kind of at least are chasing fewer squirrels. We're definitely still chasing squirrels, but we're chasing fewer squirrels.
Yeah. So before I dive into that, I'll say I gave a talk the other day at TCU where I went to school to college students about how to get your first job in real estate. It's like what you said. Some people say, like, I want to get into real estate. Well, if you're not in real estate, maybe you take nothing but from that. But when I think of it, I broke it down into three categories. What asset class do you want to be in? Do you want to be in multifamily, industrial, hotels, office, retail, self-storage? I mean, land, you can keep going on and on. Do you want to be in property management? Do you want to be in construction management? Do you want to be in asset management? Do you want to be in acquisitions, finance? Go down the list. So you can continue to break it up by multiple categories and slice it and dice it. What markets do you want to be in? And so, like you said, it can be niched down pretty hard. So real estate's a big word, but it could mean a million things to different people depending on what you get into. How we decided to get into Class B industrial, I'll take a step back. So I started the business my freshman year in college, buying rental houses around TCU. And for the first kind of 10 years, we did a lot of things. We developed student housing. We bought multifamily. We developed land. We built some office buildings. We built a lot of speculative housing. We were kind of a jack of all trades, master of none. And the first thing that came up was, as we were trying to raise more capital and do larger deals, and we started talking to professional investors, they kept telling us, like, you know, you're great. You clearly have a track record of making money. But if we're going to write you, call it a $5 million check, we would rather give it to the company that wakes up every day thinking about the same thing, because we don't know if we're going to give you this check for, call it this townhome deal, and you're going to wake up focused on student housing tomorrow because you have a student housing deal. And so that was kind of recurring. So that was the first inkling that I was like, okay, we need to probably start focusing on something. How we came into industrial was a few things. One, I think it's important in life to know what you don't want. And so I had mentioned we had been developing lots of things. We had been doing urban infill development, which is very challenging. I didn't have the patience for it. And there's a lot of risk in development that even as a great developer, you can't manage. I mean, imagine if you had been building buildings, started a project 2 years ago that you're delivering today. The world has infinitely changed. You couldn't control that. You can't control the weather when it delays construction. You can't control lots of things. And so we said, okay, we don't want to be in development. Ironically, what we ended up choosing is something we had never done before. But the word last mile was becoming big. This was 2015, 2016. So we started looking into industrial. So we knew we wanted to acquire something that was already built. We didn't want to be ground up developers. We wanted to buy something existing. Last mile and industrial and the need for buildings close to mature infrastructure was becoming a greater need. I had listened to something by Sam Zell back then, which talked about trying to buy in asset classes where supply is very constrained. And in fact, in our asset class, we believe it's depleting every year, mainly because these buildings are either repositioned into like retail or maybe creative office or some type of entertainment use, or they're torn down altogether. And that's where you see these vibrant mixed use districts coming up in all these great cities. If you trace it back, they're mostly all in old industrial parks. So we had a depleting supply class. We knew we had a huge tenant demand that we believed would continue to grow. And it was really easy to manage. a lot of what we had been managing before, managing students and Class A apartments, those are very high touch. Tenants have high demand. It's very emotional. I had a mentor telling me along the way that, you know, it was kind of a joke, but he said, you don't want to manage a, he said, eventually you don't want to manage a place where people poop at midnight. And what he meant by that was, you know, you manage somebody's house when the toilet breaks, it's very emotional. You know, they can't go to the bathroom. They need that fixed immediately. Whereas in a business, it's more of a business transaction. Businesses tend to take greater care of their space. You know, they close at 6 o'clock at night. They're typically not running 24 hours. And so Class B industrial might be one of the easiest assets to manage because these are basically rectangular boxes. They don't have to be glitzy and glammy. You have a constant supply or tenant base that's very kind of what I would call humble. They need a functional office and a warehouse that works, as opposed to like a Class A office building where you think you got to have this amazing lobby and all this art in it, and the marble has to be buffed, and you have all these tenants coming out and security. And so it's just a much more difficult management process. So the confluence of like, what do we not want to do? And then where's the world headed led us to getting into Class B industrial. And that's how we kind of niched down. And then we picked the markets we're in, one, because we're in Texas, that was easy. But then as we started looking how to expand, we were looking for markets that had similar characteristics to Texas. And that happens to be throughout the Sun Belt.
And as you say that, it really makes me think about ego and about legibility. So ego in the sense that, like, if I'm the developer that has the glitzy lobby with the art, or I see, you know, this massive construction come up, like, that feeds me in some way other than monetarily. And then also legibly, like, to the novice, to the person that hasn't maybe really deeply studied and thought about everything, it's very kind of tangible to say, hey, see this place where there is no building? What if there was a building here? It's way less legible to consider, oh, this building that's been here for 40 years that doesn't have a for sale sign on it, you know, might actually be an opportunity with an owner that is, you know, ready to move on to the next thing, or for whatever reason needs liquidity.
Yeah, a few of my developer buddies joke and they say, you know, development's not for the faint of heart, especially high-end, mixed-use, Class A stuff. They say half your return might come financially and half of it's just the satisfaction of completing a good project. And there's a lot of merit. And don't get me wrong, you can make a lot of money in development and do very well investing, but it's a labor of love. Being a developer is, you're almost like a politician, you're a businessman, you're a capital raiser, you're a visionary, you're kind of all these things wrapped into one. And again, there's successful companies that have done it extraordinarily well, but it's difficult. And, you know, we just wanted to stick to something simple that we could understand and eliminate as much risk as possible and ultimately provide good returns for our investors. And that's kind of where we landed.
So I read your annual report. You do have your own podcast. You have built a personality, which I can see on one side of the coin. When you need to go raise capital, it helps from a fundraising standpoint to have that type of brand. But on the other side, you referenced Sam Zell earlier, and I pulled this quote, frankly, there's no substitute for limited competition. You can be a genius, but if there's a lot of competition, it won't matter. And so do you ever have the concern of, by, you know, touting the benefits of Class B industrial, almost inviting more competition into your space?
Yeah, I would say, well, one, the competition has increased dramatically from when we got into it in 2016. At the time, there was a lot less competition. But for me, it's like, I've always looked at the glass or the world is like abundantly full. Is the more I've shared and the more I've talked about the benefits of industrial and spoken about it, it's never hindered our growth. It's actually brought a lot of positive to us. We've met new investors, brokers that have brought us deals, recruiting when we recruit people. Like, it's a net positive. Sure. Will there probably be a day, or it's probably happened and I don't know about it, where basically we trained a competitor. Over the long haul, I think it's the right thing to do. And like, when you look at like a Warren Buffett, and by no means do I, is this a statement to compare, But he's been one of the world's greatest sharers. He writes his annual letter. He does his annual conference. I mean, you can basically go look at his stock portfolio and you could just copy it. But I think what I guess where I'm getting at a layer deeper is the people that are best at what they do have an edge of some sort. They have a culture of some sort. They have a way of operating their business of some sort that even if I was to go on a podcast today and say every single thing that we do, the truth is, one, most people just aren't going to go do it. Two, even if they hear what I have to say, to actually put it into action would take years and years, and building a team that's cohesive and making the thousands of little mistakes that you have to make to learn to make the right ones. And by the time they caught up to maybe where we were, we would already be 5 or 6 more years down the road. And so there certainly is a lot of competition, but I've just never looked at it that way. And again, I would rest that on the best people, no matter how much they share, they have an edge that other people can't replicate no matter how much you talk about it. Because every culture is different. Every company is different. Business is people. So everybody have different people. So I have never really thought too much about the competitive set. Now, if the market got so hot to where there was no more industrial to buy and returns weren't there and it was just abundantly full of people and everybody had figured it out, we'd probably move on to something different. But it's not like we would wake up one day and had gone to sleep the night before and everything was fine and then wake up in the morning and everything had changed. The best players have an insight that competition's coming, prices are rising, and so they're probably making plans well in advance. But as I sit today, there's 22,000 buildings in the Sun Belt that meet our criteria. That's not just 22,000 industrial buildings. There's hundreds of thousands of those, but there's 22,000 in particular that meet our exact criteria in the markets that we want to be in. And I don't need all 22,000. If I can get 10 to 15 of them a year, we're going to have a great company. And until
that's a pretty good reason.
Yeah, until the writing's on the wall that we can't even get to those 10 or 15, things are good. And again, more people coming into the market, that can be a good thing at times. Again, it can saturate the market. I think the cycle that we're about to go through, real estate's, I'm not saying it's been easy the last 10 years, but the market has lifted a lot of boats. And so you haven't had to be a great operator or have some edge to make money. And in the cycle we're about to enter, or we're already in, or whatever your thoughts are on that, it's going to force the best companies will get better. And the companies that really didn't know what they were doing will either go away or they'll spend the next cycle really based on the challenges of their current portfolio, and they won't gain market share. If you look across any industry, the best companies tend to do well in the hardest of times. And we would like to think of our company as somebody that might be able to take advantage of whatever's coming in front of us.
I love that. And as we think about just operating a business, there's always, you know, a theory of constraints. There's always a constraint on the business in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, in the little reading that I've done on real estate, it's more likely that capital can be a constraint relative to some other types of businesses because you need to fund each successive deal. But, you know, the other things that often show up are, you know, talent, people that can actually operate at the high level that you need to, or the market. In your case, you're saying there's hundreds of thousands of business of buildings and 22,000 that meet your personal criteria indicates that at least for now, there is a market for you to expand into. How do you currently see the constraints on your business and how has that changed from earlier chapters of Fort?
Yeah, I think it's what you said. Real estate's expensive. It's not like a company where you can invest in a 10-person company and they can compound that and grow that into a huge organization without taking additional capital. A building can only produce so much. You know, you buy a building, it can't exponentially grow into 20 buildings, if that makes sense. So every time you're buying something new, you need more capital to do it, despite how well your other portfolio is doing. So, you know, we've been fortunate. We've built an amazing investor base over 18 years, building a track record. And so capital's not as much of a constraint. I think in the current environment, capital's a constraint for virtually everybody, a lot of it being on the debt side. Banks are more skittish to lend right now. There's other parts of the real estate environment that are more challenged. And so you're going to have banks that are, focused on that, and investors that are having to deal with their problems. Primarily, like Class B office is structurally changed forever, and there's going to be a lot of pain there. Talent is a constraint early on. When the market's really good, all the best talent is already working somewhere, for the most part. And so it can be harder to get talent in a great market, I think. And if you're a young company and you haven't really proven yourself or have a track record, it can just be hard in general to hire great talent. You kind of have to, you got to become a company that great people want to work at. And so I would say that talent has, throughout the years, I'm not saying it's been a constraint, but that's probably easing up. But I think the biggest thing right now that's a constraint is just the general capital markets. They're, from where we've been the last, 12, 13 years, they're down 80%. Transactions are down. Banks are more skittish. Equity is on the sidelines. And so while if we had a deal tomorrow, I'm confident we could get the money for it, just as a market in general, capital is constrained. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it's helpful, just the waxing and waning of that, because there's, I have a good friend, and I've cited it multiple times on this podcast. He always says, your sharks are someone else's minnows. And it can just kind of be about what chapter you're on or what stage you're at. And, Jay-Z talks about 99 problems and like the different ones he had to work through. Like you fight this dragon that feels like this enormous shark, and then you level up and you look back and you're like, oh, that was a minnow compared to what I'm dealing with now. So it's just interesting to hear that from different seats in different industries and different stages of business success.
Yep.
So take me, one more point that I wanted to try to make legible here is, often there'll be this very sharp, delineation between an entrepreneur and an investor. And, someone's talking about a startup, they're like, there's the startup founder, and then there's the VC that, is deploying capital. We can go into all these different areas. But really, a business like yours, or maybe a hedge fund or a few of these other types, a private equity firm, is really one of the few businesses where you're kind of wearing both caps. And it's actually incumbent on you to basically be successful as both a kind of business builder and an investor of capital to find success. So I think that when someone thinks about, building a portfolio of more than a billion in assets, that sounds, on its face like an investing accomplishment. But really, it's more of a business building accomplishment. So can you tell me about what you've had to learn about operating a business at this scale successfully?
Yeah. It's exactly what you said. You can buy a building and you can look at that as investing. Did you make all the right calls before you bought it? But once you buy it and you are owning it for 7 years, you're operating it. And so while we kind of fall into the real estate private equity category, we really think of ourselves as real estate operators. There's decisions we're having to make every day on CapEx, tenants, maintenance, loan covenants, all these different things. And so we're really an operating business, but in order to operate really well, we obviously have to buy good investments. And so I wouldn't call it a bifurcation, but when you think of some investors that you mentioned, like it's one thing to be an allocator of capital, like a VC, you raise a bunch of money, and then you give it to the people that are going to do the work. And not to say VCs don't take board seats and maybe actively kind of manage some of their investments, but they're not in the day-to-day, let's put it that way. And so we really are. I mean, we couldn't be in a business that's more day-to-day. And so I think it's an interesting question, because a lot of people get into the business because they're good at spotting great investments. But the afterthought of how you're going to manage these investments and build an organization that can do it at scale is building, it's like an entrepreneur. I actually consider myself more of an entrepreneur than an investor. Look, real estate's not super complicated. There's great deals you can do, and you can be a visionary and you can create outsized returns. But, a piece of real estate's like a small business. You buy a building, and that's the product that tenants are after, and they want to lease your building. And is your cost in the building and the cash flow you're bringing in from tenants going to create a positive return? Now, that's really simplifying it, But to be able to do that where we now own 35 different properties and build an organization that can not only be constantly finding deals, which is kind of, we call that our, you could put that in the investment bucket. Are we good at finding investments and making good decisions? To then raising capital and being able to fund those investments, to then being able to manage those investments day in and day out so that you're getting, you're creating the most value possible. And I think that last part is where a lot of, I would say real estate operators have the hardest time breaking through to the next level, because they're really good at finding great deals. And maybe that's good early on. And then they look up one day and they have a lot of deals that they bought, and they haven't, and the afterthought has been, how are we going to build an organization around managing those by the day? And so it's a lot of what I talk about on Twitter, on the podcast, when I talk with people, is like, how do you build the organization to fulfill all this work that needs to be done? And so from my seat, I've thought more about the business from how do we build an organization. And a great organization, again, if you're managing these things day by day, we have day by day data from our portfolio on where rents are, what tenants are in the market, what buildings cost, how much it costs to maintain them, what are costs in that market. We can easily take that data, and as we're making investment decisions on anything new to buy, it's fresh data by the day. And so it creates a nice flywheel, and that's where we are today. But there was a spot 6-7 years ago when we really hadn't thought about all the operations. We were buying deals, we were making money, but we woke up one day and we were like working on overdrive just to maintain the deals that we had bought. And that's where we really had to step back, look at the best companies in the world and say, the next 8 years is about building this incredible organization that can ingest new deals, operate them really well, and not get pigeonholed because, you know, maybe we've taken on too many deals. And so as we sit today, Fort's 52 people, and a lot of those people are in operations. They're working on the properties day to day, and our corporate kind of office that has marketing and acquisitions and finance and accounting, those people are, you know, the boots on the ground day to day, helping make good decisions on how we allocate capital.
And this may be a little bit of the secret sauce, but you're just, even operationally, most businesses, I don't know if most businesses actually do this, but could or should, is cold calling to source off-market deals. Because if you're going in and running into every kind of bidding auction, there's no chance of getting, you know, a fantastic deal or a low price. And so you built that acquisition function the same way that any other business needs an ability to go outbound and actually reach the partners that they want to do business
with. Yeah, you're only kind of as good as your pipeline, right? So you could have the best company in the world, and if you have nothing to buy or you don't have a way to source more opportunities, you've kind of limited your growth. And so if you're doing an on-market bidding process, there's a few things there. Either A, you have some operational edge that you're going to be able to operate it better than the other people bidding. B, maybe you own a lot of property in that area already, and it's accretive to add that property, even though you might be quote unquote paying market price. When you lump it into a large portfolio that you own in the area, there could be a premium that you get that others wouldn't get. And we can talk about that. So if I have, like for an example, Blackstone, they probably wouldn't buy a one-off building. It's too small. It's not worth their time. But if I can go put 10 together, not only will they buy all 10, but they'll pay a premium for it because their cost of capital is cheaper, their return thresholds are cheaper. And that was kind of the last point I was going to make in a bidding process. You might just have people that have investors that are willing to accept a lower return. So just because everybody's bidding on a $50 million deal doesn't mean everybody's investors are requiring a 20 IRR. And so that could change. But to your point on off market, how do you generate alpha in this business? You either operate extremely well and better than your competitive set, or you have a, you can call it proprietary, you can call it whatever you want, some way of sourcing deals at below market and able to do that consistently. And I think that's where what you were talking about, whether that's cold calling or creating a system where you can generate more off-market opportunities where you might be the only person bidding, or maybe it's you and a couple other people. But as soon as 200 people have a deal, you know, a lot of times, like you said, you win that auction, it can feel like a win, or it's like you were willing to pay more than everybody else. Ironically, and I'll end it on this, in a market like we were in a few years ago, where capital's flowing freely, the market's, you know, hot, finding off-market deals is really attractive. In a down market like what we're in right now, it's actually kind of flipped. And the reason why is, if you're cold calling or finding off-market opportunities, maybe that's a seller that, like, one, just by the time you call them, didn't want to sell. Maybe they are stuck in yesteryear thinking their building's still worth what it was worth. But if a broker is bringing something out, especially if they're a good broker, they've probably already told the seller, like, where we are in the market, these are the expectations you should be expecting. And so ironically, for the first time in a while, a lot of the deals that we're seeing that are might start penciling have a broker with them. Now, whether they're running a full marketing process or showing it to a small group is different, but they're deals that are probably more likely to transact, and that's because sellers' expectations have probably been brought down to earth by the time they're coming to market.
That's fascinating. I want to just touch back again on what you said. So the ability to have proprietary kind of sourcing or strategy of the deals that you're getting into, or operational excellence, is that really, like, for most people in any sort of private equity outside of real estate, is that really seems like basically the formula, right?
Proprietary deal flow, or deal flow in general, is like the heartbeat of the organization. And no matter what industry you're in, if you look at the best people in those industries, they're able to get to deals first. Maybe they've been in it a long time. They have great relationships. Maybe it's like, you know, like if you take, I'll keep going back to Warren Buffett, because a lot of people know, is like, Warren's no secret. He's got a ton of money to spend, and he's told the world a million times exactly what he's looking to buy. His proprietary edge is that he's like the only buyer of choice for a lot of businesses based on what he's capable of doing. So even though he has people that might have as much money as he has, they don't offer all the other things. You know, Blackstone, they have a war chest of money. If there's a enormous deal that comes down the pipeline, A, there's only so many companies in the world that have that much money to put to work, but people know maybe Blackstone can move quickly. Maybe they've built a reputation, so they're just going to get the first call. And so being the first call in any industry is important. In the VC world, it's probably more important than ever. A lot of the VC world is, are you going to get the first call? Are you seeing the deal? A lot of, especially early on, those rounds can go fast. And one of the biggest edges a VC has is like, did you get the call when this opportunity came up? And so I can't think of an industry where having great deal flow is not like the front end of the business. And so
that's a powerful.
I can end that by saying, you could come to Texas tomorrow. You know nothing about industrial, but you could raise $10 billion. And I'm not saying you couldn't buy stuff, but I still don't think you could come in and immediately compete with like a team like ours or others that have been in the market for 10 years, know all the brokers. We've been to dinners with them, played golf with them, closed deals with them. It just takes a long time to build those relationships. And in a world today where I think we lean on tech a lot, and we're talking about AI and all these cool, fancy tools that are all great and they serve their purpose, at least in real estate, the relationship is still the most important thing. And that takes face-to-face interaction, years of building trust, and things of that nature. And so, anyway.
Do you kind of feel like the almost like the skill of being patient for that compounds as well? Where like once you start to see the fruits of that labor, it like gets you almost like, you know, you like inverted the stimulus or inverted the like reward system, where like now you're more excited to be patient because you see the fruits of that labor that, you know, maybe you didn't see the first couple years.
For sure. And for any private equity firm, so like right now what I tell people is we have a little over $1 billion of AUM, and we collect fees on those that pay for our 52 people of overhead and all the things we do. We don't have to do a deal to keep everybody employed and do the lights on. Now, that wasn't always the case. Any investment firm early on is, they call it the J curve. They're losing money early on at the operating company level until they can get to scale. And so the nirvana is being in a position where you can do all that you want or you can do nothing, but you're not making decisions because you have to get a deal done to keep the lights on. And when you're in that position, that's where you can start making bad decisions or put your blinders on because you have to get something done. And so what you said, like, we enjoy the ability to be patient. The other thing I would say, though, is when you've been in business long enough, again, if you came in with $10 billion tomorrow, it would still take you months, if not years, to build up a pipeline of deals that are coming to you. We're at a spot now, we've been in this 9 years, that even though we're patient, every single day, three deals walk into our office. Now, we might not do the next 100 that come in, but we're able to be patient, but we're also able to see a lot. So while it might seem like some companies are more active than others, it's this balance of like, they can be patient, but because they see so many deals on a regular basis, they probably look more active than other people that aren't seeing as much, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and even further, it compounds your skill of actually like, what is the current state of the market? How are things changing? What does a good deal look like? You know, the person that goes out to eat twice a day is just going to have better taste than the person that goes out to eat once a
month. And what, you know, you hear like in real estate, and I'm sure it's this way in other industries, you hear the term pencils down. In a bad market, pencils down means, you know, the market's going down. Let's all go take a holiday. We're not going to underwrite deals. There's nothing that pencils. We take the complete opposite approach. To us, like the market's the market. It's going to go up, it's going to go down, but that shouldn't change how many deals we're underwriting, how many offers we're making. Now, we might make more offers that never get approved, but our team, you would not notice a difference between when the market was the best and today as far as how many deals we're underwriting, how many we're making offers on. And because we're doing that, brokers keep sending us deals because they know we're active. Our hit rate right now is much lower because seller expectations are a little bit off, but the way to stay in the market, to be the first call, is to stay in the market.
Amen. That triggers one more question. You keep giving me such good nuggets, I keep running the boat off it. Is there a story of a deal or a particular location that you had to chase or stick with for an inordinately long time? Like maybe you made the first offer, didn't land, second offer didn't land, third offer didn't land, and then finally through diligence, through patience, you were able to...
Yeah, so it's like in stocks, you can just go online and click a button and you own what you want to own in a second. Some of the best deals we've ever done, we worked on for 2 or 3 years before we got them under contract. And so, you know, one deal that comes to mind is it was a very large deal. Family had owned it for 30 years. We made a deal on it within the first 3 months, a verbal agreement. We moved to contract. You know, the gentleman that was the patriarch was in his late 80s. His wife got sick. And he said, look, I'm just going to press pause. I'm going to focus on getting my wife healthy. And then he said, and by the way, we've realized we want to move these assets into a trust. And for 2 years, we followed up with those folks every 3 months, just checking in, stayed in front of them. It would have been very easy for us to just kind of move on and go focus elsewhere. But in our system, it was something that we wanted to check in. And one day we walked into the office. We weren't expecting it. We got a call from the gentleman and he said, you know, my wife is healthy. Everything's been moved into the trust and we're ready to go. And, you know, by the way, because y'all have been worked with us and I'm a man of my word, I'm going to honor the deal I made you 2 years ago. And we got a deal done. They don't all happen that way, but especially the bigger deals that are owned by families or family offices or private investors, it can be a lot more handholding than when a professional institution owns it, where they're just transacting every 3 to 5 years and they're intending on selling, you know, every few years. So yeah, I would actually tell you that the best deals we've ever done are ones that took the longest to get done.
I love stories like that. Thanks for sharing. Chris, this has been fantastic. I've learned a lot. I'm sure the audience has as well. I want to aim towards wrapping up, but before I ask our challenge at the end, is there anything you're hoping to share today that I just didn't give you a chance to?
No, I think if there was just anything to wrap it up is kind of what I was saying, and this applies to every industry. When things are really good, obviously that feels good, but there's a lot more competition that can enter the market. There's lower barriers to entry. There's more capital available for everybody. There's not as many inefficiencies in the market. In a time that we're like kind of in right now and maybe going into, where it's becoming more challenging. Interest rates are higher. There's not as much capital available. This is like the perfect time for people to get started doing something that they wanted to do. It's the perfect time. There's just going to be a lot of opportunity out there. And I just encourage anybody listening is like, use it to your advantage. It's easy to look at the news and be frightened by things. But if you really just go back throughout history, like these things happen every 10, 12 years, they're nothing new. And if you really study the best at what they've done, they've used times like this to get much better. It's not to say they don't have their issues maybe while they're going through it, but the best companies get much better, or the best companies start in times that are more challenging. And so I would just wrap up that whole talk on just, there's no better time than now to get started doing whatever you're doing.
Right on. I love it. Chris has a fantastic podcast, and people should go check it out on YouTube and all the different podcast platforms. But in addition to link into that, Chris, what other digital coordinates can we provide people if they want to learn more about what you're
on? Yeah, so thank you for mentioning it. It's the Fork podcast, and been doing it for 4 years. And I interview entrepreneurs and owners and founders and C-suite executives in business. You can follow me on Twitter at Fort Worth Chris. That's probably where I'm most active. Or you can check out our real estate company's website, www.fortcapitallp.com.
Right on. We're going to link that all in the show notes. People can find it in the app. We're probably listening to this right now. We're at goingdeeperthearon.com/podcast for every episode of the show. Chris, before I let you go, I'd like to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable challenge to the audience.
I think it's a great question. My entire life, and I think most of our lives, like maybe when I was younger, I thought, yeah, I'm self-made. But I don't think that's true at all. I don't think anybody's really self-made. My entire life has been characterized by mentorship from folks that have walked the walk, whether that's in business, fatherhood, faith, family, people with wisdom that have walked the walk. And it's come natural to me to always have mentors and to reach out to folks that have, you know, done the thing I want to do, no matter what that is. And for a long time, I just thought everybody had a mentor. And so my challenge to anybody, if you don't have a mentor, and there's something that you want to do, and maybe you don't have the confidence yet to go do it, one of the best ways to move forward is to find a mentor. And a mentor is a specific type of relationship. It's not just taking somebody to lunch and talking to them for an hour and trying to gain wisdom. It's an intentional relationship where the mentor and the mentee know what it's about. You talk regularly, and they know that they're mentoring you to help you get into real estate or to help you become a better father or whatever that is. And I would tell you, you could skip years of your career and hundreds of costly mistakes by finding someone that you trust that will pass their wisdom on to you. And the good news is that I've always found most people that have been successful in something and are later on in their careers, most people are actively willing to share and engage with younger folks that are trying to make it and trying to get their start in life. And so my challenge to anybody would be, if you don't have a mentor, go find a mentor.
And in my limited experience, what I've to add on, I'd love your perspective too on just kind of earning that buy-in from the person that's more successful from you is empathy, energy, earnestness, where you're not trying to like, hey, take me out to dinner and like, let's spend 4 hours talking, because they don't have, nor do they want to spend that amount of time. Energy in the sense of like, not just excited about it, but you bring an optimism, you bring a kind of like new, fresh thing that they maybe see in a past version of themselves. And then earnestness in the sense that like, maybe it's not the perfect word, but I was going for like the three E's there, and I'm doing it on the fly, of like, you know, you're not, you know, misrepresenting yourself. You're not like acting like you're bigger than you are. You're like, this is where I am. These are the headaches. These are the like potholes that I recently tripped over. And like, what do you see, person that's hopefully escaped the kind of situation?
Yeah, it's exactly kind of what you said, is you got to have humility about it. The folks that your mentors are not expecting you to be an expert. In fact, you wouldn't be going to them maybe if you were, is one, be really intentional. So the first person you ask to be a mentor might not say yes, but if you wanted to get into Class B industrial real estate, you might find make a list of 10 folks. Two, when you do meet with them, their time is valuable. It's not a time to, they're not just look, while you might make friends with them, they're not looking for another, you know, friendly lunch. Come prepared to talk about things. Send them an email before you meet with them. Hey, here's the things I want to go over today. Treat it almost like a teacher-student relationship. What ultimately happens is you build a close relationship through it. Be really vulnerable. Don't use it as time to not really share what's challenging you, and treat it like a professional relationship. And like I said, know that their time is valuable. And so make it as valuable for them as you can, as they're going to make it for you. But again, it's a very powerful thing, and you can have mentors in all facets of life. It doesn't just have to be business.
Absolutely. I could not endorse the challenge more, Chris. Thank you so much for spending your time with
us
today. You
bet. Thanks for having me.
We just went deep with Chris Powers. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Hey, thanks for listening to the end of my conversation with Chris. If you enjoyed this, I think you'd also enjoy our conversation with Brent Beshore. His firm, Permanent Equity, specializes in buying small businesses and has built their specialty and niche focus there. Go check it out.